into which you project the doings of your past, for you are still mistaking dreams for realities. The judgment of the judge of the dead is your judgment of yourself. It is not the judgment of the great Dharmakaya. Love is love. In pure love there is no judgment, for then the love would not be pure. You pronounce your own judgment of yourself and sentence yourself to your next rebirth. The great Dharmakaya, being pure love, does not sentence you. Yourself is not its problem. The hellhounds who carry out the punishment to which you sentence yourself are the creations of your own mind, as is this court and its sentence. You created the judge of the dead, the gods and the demons, with your own karma. Know this. Awaken to this. Go straight to the Dharmakaya and be free. Another quats.
You still get another chance, even now. Although you will be reborn, you've still got another chance to clean up all the karma.
A week later. If you are still not one with the great Dharmakaya, you will now know that you are dead for the first time.
And this is real death.
And you may not know what to do. Since you clung to a separate self, you know that that self must have a body for it to feel comfortable and safe. Therefore you are tossed hither and yon, squeezed between rocks, burned on red-hot coals, as the flames of your karma drive you on. You must know that
this
it is you...
This is not punishment, it is consequence.
You must know that it is you who created it, and you who sentenced yourself to it. All of this is your doing. Upon the dark horizon there now appear the six lights of the six worlds of rebirth. The light of that world to which you have sentenced yourself will shine the brightest. These lights will seem safer than the first blinding flash of light of the great Dharmakaya, but they are still part of it, in a form which you are prepared to accept. For pure love will appear in whatsoever form the beloved desires, and will never desert the beloved, no matter how many times the latter may turn away. According as you have sentenced yourself, you may go to a heaven for a little while, should you have done some good. If you judged yourself as jealous or ambitious, your lot will be that amongst the Titans. You may have sentenced yourself to be a human as a result of clinging to your erudition. Nice for us universities. or to being an animal as a result of your believing that you do not have the Buddha nature. Perhaps you have sentenced yourself to be a ghost or to enter the hells. However, know that the great Dharmakaya is in all of these worlds.
Now, I would point out that you have sentenced yourself to this, the yourself there, meaning that part of you that was judged, is now going to a critical mass that is in that situation. Okay? So.
It was its light that guided you to a world that you have sentenced yourself. Think on the great Dharmakaya. Know that all of these worlds are unreal. Abandon your false separate self. Stay still in meditation. Love all the worlds and all beings. You are the source of all of these worlds. Do not move from your true center. Love the great Dharmakaya. Say, I am willing to go to the great Dharmakaya, and you will immediately be free. Do not fear. Be still in meditation.
This is something you have to do with a vengeance when you're actually meditating, because you do get the six worlds that beckon. If you read the beginnings of Lotus Blossom, you'll see there are the lights beckoning on either side of a mountain, and they're so fascinating. And I'm saying, no, I'm going up that mountain, I'm going up to that tiny, and you can't even see the tiny spot of light in the beginning. Never mind, I don't want this, I'm going up that mountain. And it gets darker and darker, and still you can see these lights off through little holes in the mountain. But there's the one that you follow. So you go backwards through this when on the preparation run. Sorry, go on.
Last one. This is the 49th day after clinical death, before the final memorial ceremony. If you are still not one with the great Dharmakaya, listen now with all of your might. Your desire to be reborn is becoming overwhelming, since your false view of self needs the physical organs of sense to give it expression. Because of this desire, you are as in an arid desert, longing for water and finding none. There are no resting places here, for fearful shapes from your former unconscious self rear up to drive you on with screams, threats, and torments. The wind of karma hurls you through the scorching air and you long for a body. All the beings you see around you are copulating, and according as you have sentenced yourself to be male or female, so you will hate the sex that you have chosen for yourself and love the one that you have not. If you do not choose a specific sex, you may have no hatred or love for either, and may be born as a homosexual. Do not interfere between the copulating couples or become part of them. One of them is your parents to be. Allow their intercourse to take place naturally and do not interfere. Allow yourself to be reborn. Accept the state of physical rebirth. In whatever world you've sentenced yourself to, the great Dharmakaya is to be found. Willingness and humility are the key to becoming one with it.
Being a priest is quite a hefty job in Buddhism. And you have no right, they are very, very rough about letting anyone do a funeral ceremony in the East unless he really has done this once himself. Because he cannot know when to start the exhortations. Now, the exhortations as I have written them are not exactly as they are written in the East, because they can't be. Everybody makes them up as they go along. My master told me the main gist of what I've got there. I wrote it down and have fleshed it out. I believe there is something somewhat similar in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but I don't know. All the real Buddhist sects have this. I strongly suspect the Christians do, the really good Christian monasteries. If you go through the back of the book in Lotus Blossom, you will see the fundamental, as I said, the fundamental stages of this, the sitting down to meditation, the checking of the breathing and discovering the rightful path of the breathing, the appearance in the center of oneself of one's true nature, the passing of that true nature outside of oneself, which is exactly what happens at death, the recognition of its purity, and the allowing of it to come back in, the inviting of it back in. Well, at the time of death, it passes outside of oneself and goes through all these stages. When you do it in meditation, it passes outside of oneself and one goes through all these stages. But you do bring it back in again, or you're going to kick the bucket, which is why I say be very careful how you do this, or you can die. Do not have your eyes closed. Because if you do it thoroughly and if you do it properly, it can be a little dangerous if you're stupid. After all, you are preparing to do the greatest thing of your life. We do preparation for everything except the one thing we're most scared of. And that's the one thing we should prepare most for. Now let's take some questions, because go ahead, you want to write something.
Comment, which is that, to me, one of the other things which these exhortations say, not just to a priest, to anyone, is that if you feel, after the death of a friend or a loved one, that there is something still unquiet, there is something that you can actually do to help them.
Yes.
And you have to stay still in your own meditation and know what it is that's unquiet, and know in what way it is unquiet. And you can, in fact, help that.
Yes.
Which is still unquiet.
And that is the duty of the priest, as well as all the relatives and friends.
Yes.
Even if a priest has done some exhortations and a relative or friend feels that something is not yet quiet, he can redo them.
Yes. Or whatever is the equivalent.
Enough, you always seem to know exactly where the person is, if you're deep enough in meditation,
yes,
to know which one of these to do,
or
which equivalent.
Yeah. And there's no necessity to do, if once these things get published in the Book of Life, there's no necessity for anyone to follow the Buddhist form of this.
But the dreams that are most useful are the ones that come usually just before morning, at the time of the what is called the liver flow, because it is said in Buddhism that the Buddha nature, or Holy Spirit, or soul, whichever you like to call it, lives in the hara by day and in the liver by night. And what you won't take notice of by day, it lets you dream out by night. That is actually a Buddhist belief, and I've proved it true for me. Yes, you said you were going to say.
In talking about death, we presume the person is one of a certain level of emotional and intellectual maturation. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, death does take people of 10 years. Now, how do you counsel talking to somebody who's going to die who's quite young?
Just love God and don't worry at all. Just love God. He loves you as I love you, only much, much more. Just talk of all the beauty. Talk of all the beauty that they're going to see, all the love, and how they should open their arms, just literally open their arms to accept it in. When somebody gets close to the end of a big kensho, when they've gone through all the early stages, one of the things that you finally do is this. They sort of keep their left hand terribly closed. And one of the things I have to do is say, open your left hand, open your left hand. You've got to let it in, you've got to let it in. And if they can open their left hand, if they can be completely open, it can enter. And one of the things you have to watch with a child dying is that the left hand is open. I cannot explain why or how this works, except that energy seems to come in via the left and go out via the right. Go ahead.
Well, I think the first thing you mentioned about love that had been somewhat...
saddened love.
Yes, slightly saddened love. And you said you would go into that a bit. I don't think you have.
No, I haven't. You're right. Would you like to take that? Because you and I had a big discussion on this.
This is something that come about to find by tracing back a chain of karmic causation, either in this lifetime or through a series. And so far, I've never found an exception to this. That at its source, at the source of this chain of unfortunate or painful karma, there is not an evil act. I don't really know what an evil act is anymore.
There is no such thing as an evil act, really.
There's simply there's a purity and a love which somehow, and there are a lot of ways this can happen, was unable to be expressed completely or was unable to be understood and therefore came out slightly twisted. Was unable to be expressed, was unable to be shared, and therefore became slightly saddened.
Next time
or resigned.
A little more.
And as a result of that, some action was done which created suffering instead of communicating love. And that suffering, if it wasn't understood, and if the person's then existent, or in earlier in one's own lifetime, if oneself didn't understand the causes of that suffering and get back to the original purity of love, that suffering can then produce further suffering, which even further saddens or resigns or twists the original loving desire. Until in the end you can, until someone does something about it, end up with a tendency or a behavior or a proclivity which appears to be absolutely depraved, or absolutely evil, or absolutely perverted. But if that desire or proclivity or tendency or set of actions or habitual actions is not rejected, is not turned away from, is not condemned as evil or perverted, but is accepted and treated with love and treated with respect, you eventually can get back to the thing which was there originally. And when you do that, that is the transformation and the transcending of what appeared to be evil and perverted.
And it is so terribly important not to get guilt involved on the way, because as man understands it, there may be guilt involved as we understand our present day morality, and there may look as though there is guilt involved, but you've really got to keep guilt out of the way. It's not a matter of guilt. You got to get beyond that.
Guilt acts as a lock on a karmic chain like this.
Guilt can make it impossible to break a karmic chain.
Because it sort of implies, therefore I am evil, or therefore I am bad, or therefore I am unworthy to.
Or worse still, fear can enter in because of the guilt, and you won't do anything about it in case somebody thinks you are guilty, and therefore somebody's going to send you to jail, or somebody's going to do this, or somebody's going to do that. There is an exquisite story called Beyond the Pale of Vengeance, which is an old Zen story which really shows the true working out of karma. I don't know that you can get it in this country.
It's in the title, and I can't remember the name of it. I read it in the paper.
It's exquisite. But that is exactly how it's done. But I don't know I've got another book to write. I'm not at all sure what the world is going to do with it, because you see, over here, we've got that is just one step up for an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. People who have broken the law have got to be punished. People who have done this have got to go to jail. They've got to have this, they've got to have that. And that very thing puts a lock on karma, but you can't just let people go free who break the law. Somehow, somewhere, sometime in existence, we have got to get it to a state when we can look at the so-called criminal and see when this person is going to be able and is willing to clean up his karmic stream. And when he is not willing, and when he's not willing, we send him to jail. And when he is willing, we put him in the situation where he can do it. But what judge could do that? I think where the judges are going to have to be before we can get to that state. They're all going to have to be saints, as the world understands it. So I really don't know when it's ever going to happen. But that is the ideal thing. That is the ideal situation.
Do you think Zen masters made that?
Zen masters are still human. They make mistakes. It's very important for them to remember that. They don't make too many, but they do make some. I would tremble to do that job.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, if a person wished to clean up his act, but was unable to, through weakness, fell into the same patterns, how does that fit in
with all this? Oh, look, the ramifications and the complications are endless.
I would say that's where I'm going to switch hats for a moment and put on my shrink hat. I would say that's where shrinks come in.
I would agree with you.
Just helping somebody to do something that they want to do, but they can't quite find the way to do it.
Because in many respects, shrinks are people who very sincerely have tried to take over the job of the priesthood because the priests have forgotten what that job is. Forgive me for saying that in the West. And I don't think the East has forgotten what that job is, which is why their form of religion is much more threatening to the present established religions in this country. It's much more alive, and therefore attracts the young much more. That's my private opinion on this. Go ahead. Sorry. Is somebody, anybody else? Go ahead.
In the mudras,
yeah.
I know in the acupuncturist feel that if someone's had previous surgery or manipulation, you know, that it's very difficult to get through because the meridians are all disturbed. Is that the same with the mudras?
Yep. Not necessarily difficult, but it requires extra effort and sometimes requires altering the mudra. Sometimes it requires doing a lot of work on the actual site of the injury or surgery.
I would say in one sense it's easier with the mudras because you pick up the fact that there's a block all that much more quickly because of the very proximity of another person to the area.